Welcome to the Repair Ed podcast, where we reflect on education and reimagine equitable futures. I'm Claire Neves, a researcher who worked in education in the city of Bristol in the southwest of England for over 15 years. In each episode, I'll talk to educators and thinkers about current injustices in our schooling system and their ideas for creating fairer educational futures. This podcast forms part of Repair Ed, a five-year project funded by UKRI to examine educational inequality in Bristol's primary schools. Welcome to another episode of the Repair Ed podcast. Today I'm in London with Curtis Worrell from Class 13, a charity aiming to transform education by putting equity and relationships at the heart of what they do. Curtis, do you want to start off by introducing yourself and telling us a bit about Class 13?
Yeah, so I'm Curtis. Founder of Class 13. Class 13 is turning 5 today, so we're very excited about to celebrate that a little bit later. My background, was a youth worker for around 16 years, working with young people in schools and prison and housing. And I guess like over that time, like many professionals working with children and young people, we start to see the same, different young people, same challenges, and thinking actually there's got to be something underlying. So Class 13 was set up to do that. So we work predominantly with teachers, schools, people, professionals working with children and young people to kind of think about our own practices and think about how our practices might mirror harm, like, or be, yeah, to be harmful, and thinking about that. Because I think when we, if we practice in a way where we don't really pay attention to that and not kind of cognizant of that, then we're always going to cause more harm if we're not kind of alert to that. And yeah, so that's the kind of work that Class 13 does.
Brilliant, thank you. Our project, Repair Ed, focuses on educational inequality in the city of Bristol. And we've seen a lot of deficit ideology in the way that people talk about their own experiences of schooling and the pupils they teach. But we can also see how the current curriculum and accountability measures set up teachers to view pupils from marginalised backgrounds in this way. Can you share a little bit about how you challenge those deficit narratives at Class 13?
Yeah, so I think like for us, deficit ideology is probably one of the underpinning ideologies that we all kind of ascribe to in so many ways. And I think it's not something that we tend to talk about a lot. We talk about, like, I guess, like the outcomes. So we might talk about attainment, or we might talk about poverty, and we talk about all these other kind of things around it. But we really focus on deficit ideology. And I think the really helpful thing about the model of deficit ideology is that once you see it for yourself, like you see it and you understand it, how it impacts your life, because it does impact everybody's life, then you can also see it for your young people. So for us, it's like building awareness and really showing people that, like, you know, that when we are kind of targeting young people, what we're asking a young person to do is we're asking them to kind of be more resilient to the harms that they're facing. And then we call that success. And yeah, for us, that's not a marker of success. That's a marker of survival. And I think we do that so often that we also have like all of these, I guess, what we would term as successful young people who are kind of working through the system and they're more resilient to the system. Then we look at them as examples and say, well, if you just work a little bit harder, then everything will be okay. Like, again, just blaming the young people. And I think this for us, I think if you look at education, like the harms that have been caused, like to children on free school meals, children racialized as non-white, girls, if you've got an additional need, like it basically, it's like most young people are going to be harmed in the system. We know that. And yet we continue to perpetuate that. And then we pull young people out occasionally to work with them one-to-one, acting like that's going to do something, even though the kind of statistics of that harm have kind of been, you know, like they've been around for 50 plus years. It's almost like, I don't know, it's frustrating because it's like, we know, and we're like, just not too sure. You're like, well, we do, because I think even if you were to speak to any kind of professionals, especially working in education, when they get their first intake of year sevens or year fives or whatever it looks like, they can spot the ones that are not going to be able to make it as well. So I'm like, so you know.
Yeah, for sure.
but yet you still blame them at the end. Like when it's, when the young person gets excluded, that's, they were always going to get excluded. We're like, oh, we tried our best. I'm like, nah, we didn't. And we didn't even try our best, and we didn't even learn from that. So we're just going to perpetuate it, and we're perpetuating it probably at the same time that we are, like talking about that. It all becomes very challenging. And I think we're just making like rods for our own backs, really, like, so we could undo that and have an easier kind of engagement of children and young people if we just didn't move in those ways.
Yeah. And I've definitely, so I taught for 15 years, and I definitely felt that tension of kind of knowing that what I was doing was not the right thing for, yeah, let's be real, most of the students I taught. You know, if you ask me to say the ones who kind of did really well within the system, you know, it was a handful in each class. So yeah, it was clear it wasn't working, but being complicit in that system and kind of still chasing those accountability measures, you know, the progress, the achievement, the, you know, the attendance, all of those things, it's difficult when you're in it, I guess, to see a way out. And I think one of the really useful things that Class 13 does is just sort of slow things down for teachers to be able to reflect.
Yeah.
So what sort of things do you do when you work with schools and with teachers to get them to be able to really see that deficit ideology?
Yeah, so one of the really helpful ways that we do is in the very beginning, before we start engaging with the teachers, we ask them think of a student in your class that is displaying challenging behavior. What does that look like? What would you do? And what do we think the underlying causes are? And it's like, that's really interesting, because one, they already know they're going to come onto our course, so they're putting their best foot forward.
Mm.
But yet, every time they write something down, it's pretty, it is deficit ideology. And we don't even, at the beginning of the course, we don't look at it, because we're like, there's no benefit for us looking at it at the beginning. We might as well just look at the end when everyone else does. And then when we get to the end, after we've kind of explained what deficit ideology is, we give a lot of examples of kind of ways that they can find it in different people's practices. And then we just give it back to them and be like, what do you think? And then they're like, oh. And
wow.
We have like this really, this, a thing that we do in our training, essentially, is like, when we ask them about these three underlying causes, a helpful example is that one of the underlying causes a teacher put down a couple of years ago was that the young person's mum has a full-time job, and therefore the young person can't access after school activities and these types of things. But what we get them to do right at the end is to say, and is to kind of expose the kind of myth that they're telling themselves, is to flip it and go, so if so-and-so's mum didn't work full-time, then everything would be all right. And they're like, oh, that sounds horrible. But I'm like, that's what you said. Like, the underlying problem is the mum works full-time.
Mm.
Do we want her to work less? Like, what's going on? And then we have to kind of pick apart and go, actually, what is that? Because there's young people in the schools whose mums do work part-time, and they're still not, everything's not okay for them. So it's like, what are we actually going to do? And I think when we think about what we can do, I think it's like slightly frustrating for us, because I think you've even spoke about it in terms of like not knowing where to kind of turn, like not knowing what to do. And for us, I'm like, go with what you know to be true. Like, we know that like shouting at people is not nice, right? So we probably shouldn't do that. We know that like isolating people from other people is also not kind, and it's also like very much linked in, like, if we saw that in a relationship, that would be a red flag and we would stop doing that. We also know, which is probably one of the bigger kind of bits that perpetuates this, is that we don't live in a meritocracy, right? So if we don't live in a meritocracy, so that means the grades can't be the most important thing, because they matter, but so many other factors are going to play into that, whether or not that young person is successful in this kind of model of what success looks like. We also know that these other things, if in other environments would be considered harm, just go with what we know to be true. So then we're like, actually, it doesn't make any sense to do that in order to kind of to get the young person to get the grades to be able to do this thing, because that's a lie. This is truth. We can then make our decision. And like, I reckon if you was to speak to any of my previous like bosses, they would say like they've asked me to do things in the past, and I just say no. I think that's harmful to young people, mm-hmm. and that for me is like, where my boss would have asked me to do something, I could have just done it. Now we're having a conversation about whether or not it's harm or not, mm-hmm. which is a helpful conversation to have in that moment, because otherwise we would just keep doing it. And it's just like, actually, if we just slow down for a moment, now I'm saying that's harm. Now you've got to convince me that it's not harmful. But in order to convince me it's not harmful, you've got to accept a little part that it might be. And now we're having a different type of conversation, which is going to kind of impact his practice. It's going to impact my practice. It's going to impact other people's practices. Because if we then choose that, like, we're not going to do that, then it goes back up the chain to say, well, we don't do that anymore because it's harmful.
Mm.
And now we're having a conversation about the harm that we cause, rather than always thinking about the harm that is external to young people or external to us as professionals. It's, I don't know, I think we just do what we know to be true, and we do what we can do, rather than keep pointing the fingers at everybody else, because everybody is part perpetrator, part victim. That's just the society in which we live in.
Yeah, we've been on our project, we've been working with the ideas of Michael Rothberg. So it's an idea of complex implication, and it's beyond kind of the victim-perpetrator split. And I think that's really important for sort of teachers to grapple with, you know, teachers who are complicit in the system, that it isn't that straightforward. And I guess what you've just said makes me feel quite hopeful, and I hope teachers listening sort of feel quite hopeful who maybe are embedded in these systems where, you know, they've got a school that runs an isolation room. And like you've said, you know, if someone was isolating someone in a relationship, you'd be like, wow, major red flag. But we do it in schools across the country all the time.
Yeah.
And I bet you there are a lot of teachers listening to this who are like, yeah, I know sending kids to isolation is wrong, but my school's behaviour management policy. But just that little bit of power that you've given back to teachers there to say, just say, well, hang on, I think that's harmful. Can you tell me why it's not?
Yeah.
Is huge. Like that's, and I think it's those kind of like little micro resistances in the system, isn't it, that kind of are gonna add up. But I guess, do you, bigger than that, do you work with whole schools on kind of systemic change to?
So right now what we're doing is working with two schools in Lambeth, Henry Fawcett and Lillian Bayliss. We're gonna be working with them for 4 years. And our plan is, so for us, we have four key principles. And they are, so the first one is affirming. So making sure that everybody feels valued just for being a human being, not because they're good at maths or not because they're good at English or they're good at football. That's like, that's fine. But we want to be like, you are valuable because you're a human being. That's it. And then the second one is critical thinking. So really supporting young people and adults in that space to think critically. So like when I'm saying to my boss, I think that's harmful, that's critical thinking, right? Because now we're engaging in something. And then the last one, well, not the last one, the next one is community. So being intentional in building community. So if we're like, if we think that community is important, then isolating a young person becomes like just illogical. Like we can't do that because we're trying to intentionally build community. So that means that every interaction we have, like wherever it's with a parent, another teacher, a young person, do you know what I mean? Anybody, we're trying to strengthen the relationship that we have or build or support them to build further relationships. And like, that seems to make sense. And then if we do all of those three things really well, then what we will have is, democracy. So then we'll have like a real kind of case of democracy because we are listening to people. We are kind of supporting them to kind of build relationship and be together. So the outcome of that is democracy. And I'm like, that for us is feels like the most logical way. And it's like the thing we'll say is that I don't know what the future is going to look like, but I think when we get there, those four things will be key in order to kind of move us to the next step. The next step. And I think there's two things on that is that like you can build an environment where young people expect democracy, mm-hmm. right? Because at the moment we're kind of educating young people in a space of kind of coercion and kind of just these kind of really punitive pressures. That when they go to their job, they expect their manager to be dominating, and their manager expects to be dominating because that's how we've seen power being used. We're just like, that's what we do. We see it with young people. Like, why are the year 11s pushing year 7s? I can pretty much tell you as to why the year 11s are pushing year 7s, because it's the same reason why the teachers are not being particularly kind to the TAs. Like, it's all, and why the head teacher is not being, do you know what I mean? Like, all of that is just trickling down, and everyone's like, oh, when I get power, this is what I'll do. Mm-hmm. But the second thing is like, if you pick any kind of challenge that like young people are facing, so if you think about like grooming or gangs or violence or anything like this, it's like, so if a young person felt affirmed in themselves, mm-hmm. would it reduce their vulnerability to that? If they had a community around them, mm-hmm. who they were in critical conversation with, again, it would reduce their vulnerability to that. So for me, I'm like, it just makes sense, because the more we take that away, we're actually increasing the young people's vulnerability to that. If you're standing in the front of a classroom and you're telling young people that like, this is this, like an adult says this, therefore you have to do it and you can't question that, then you meet an adult on the street and they say, I want you to do this, then you do it. And it's also like, I guess we're talking about education, but I think we can also talk about youth work in that, because mm-hmm. in youth work, what we do, and I speak as a youth worker, like we find out what the young person likes, then we give the young person what they like. Mm-hmm. And then we ask them to do something that we don't think they would have done when we first met them. I'm like,
sounds pretty coercive, doesn't it?
It's all there. So yeah. Like, if we were in a critical dialogue with mm-hmm. the young person about that, then things could be very different. But we are forever increasing young people's vulnerability to things. And when we do that, we start to think about things like social media. And we're like, oh, what we need to do is we need to be more controlling about young people with social media. So we should just tighten the net. And what's that going to do? It's going to mean young people go underground. They're going to be more vulnerable to more exploitation, blah, blah, blah. But if we instill those four principles, then we don't have to be scared of social media, because we're scared of social media now. Before, in my day, we were scared of like Eminem's album. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're always scared of something. Mm-hmm. And how are we going to kind of waylay that fear? The four principles. It's like, it's so simple for us. I'm just like, just do those things mm-hmm. and do them well and keep trying to do those as best as possible. And we will have an outcome that is better. That's got to be my belief. I'm just like, yeah. It makes sense, it tracks.
It does, yeah. And it kind of feels like with young people, we're doing this like dual thing of like, you must be resilient, and like putting all this responsibility onto them to solve all their own problems and, you know, to take the responsibility for failure. But then on the other hand, we're kind of saying, you're not responsible enough to engage in this critical dialogue. We're going to tell you exactly what to do and you do it. But then when it goes wrong, we're going to blame you for it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, I think that community and that affirming young people feels really, really empowering. And it's interesting to hear you talk a little bit about youth work with that kind of critical like reflection.
The thing I would say about youth work as well is that, so we work with a lot of teachers and we work with some mm-hmm. youth workers. And when we work with teachers are used to that critique. Like, they're used to the kind yeah. of schools are not doing great and mm-hmm. therefore. But youth workers, like, mm-hmm. and I speak as a youth worker, like, we think we're the best. Like, we think we're better than social workers because young people choose to engage with us. Because yeah. we're better than teachers because the relationship is informal. Yeah. So, like, when we come to kind of understand, like, if we think we're the best, we're going to cause harm because we're just walking through the world, like, do you know what I mean? Without a care in the world. But we have to go, actually, like, the harm that we cause is always going to be there. Like, my first lecturer, he used to say that, like, and he was lecturing on youth work, he would call us like the cupboard police, because he'd be like, we're still saying the same thing. So all of the services are saying the same thing. They're saying, do this or else. So teacher says, do this or else. The youth worker says, do this or else. Social worker says, do this or else. Please say, do this or else. But there or else is always consistent. Whereas like you can meet a youth worker on one day and it could be fine. You can meet a teacher on one day and it'd be fine. But if you meet a police officer, they're usually quite consistent. And I feel like they're kind of, there's also like a bit with young people, for some young people who are able to see a police officer and kind of go, this could be, you know, they have like an amber warning. They're like, this could potentially be harmful. Mm. Let me brace for impact. Do you know what I mean? Whereas if a young person meets me, they're not bracing for impact. They're like, he seems cool. Like, do you know what I mean? And we're engaging with things. We're talking about the things I like. He likes football. We like football, blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, do yourself still. Like, so we have to think about our practices and ways. And I'll say that, like, the analogy I use is a lot is like, when we drive, we know that cars are dangerous, right? And they have a potential to kill someone. Mm-hmm. They have a real potential to kind of be harmful. But you can still enjoy driving, but you just have to keep your eyes peeled and kind of drive with due care and attention. And that's what we have to do with our practice. We can still enjoy our practice. We can still kind of, you know, like, yeah, kind of go and do it and be happy with that. But we just have to go, is the light green? Do you know what I mean? Is that person going to stop? Is that person going to step into the road? Like, is my practice harmful? Yes, no, maybe. But if we're always asking ourselves, is it harmful, and we slow our practice down, then we'll be better for it, because the enemy of equity is pace, is speed. It's always going to be speed. The quicker we move, the more inequitable we're going to be. So we just have to slow down. And the best way to slow down is to keep asking ourselves, is this harmful? Same with car.
I feel like I had an almost like visceral reaction when you said about pace. Because, like, having stepped away from working in schools, like, I used to think that I just wasn't very good at sleeping. Like, I thought I don't sleep well. You know, when people would be like, how do you sleep? I'd be like, oh, rubbish. But, you know, I'm not a good sleeper. Yeah. When I stepped away from the classroom last year, I started sleeping through the night.
Okay.
And it was just, the pace of schools is just so intense. And it is, there is no time. And like, you might sit down and have these conversations in September about, you know, potential harm that might be caused. You know, you've got your kind of pastries and your coffee on an inset day. You're sitting there, you're having these really critical conversations. And then suddenly you kind of look up and it's June and you've kind of realized, we haven't been asking those questions. Yeah. So how can you like embed that criticality and that reflection in like the sort of everyday cycle of schools when they're trying to work so quickly?
So I think going back to the four principles, I think you could use the four principles to observe lessons and like and be asking teachers, like, how was that affirming? Like, just keep using that language. Mm-hmm. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think also with behavior management, I think obviously, like in schools, we're recording that. And I think one of the things we're not recording is, like, how was this interaction harmful to this young person? Imagine at the time we're writing down, oh, they did X, they did Y. How was my interaction harmful to this young person? Or how did, or like, where did they learn this behavior? Or how did I teach them this behavior as well? It's like a really interesting question, because again, it goes back to like, they've seen us use power in these particular ways. Are they just replicating the power that we show? And I think it's always like interesting when I go into schools and they have what will they say to me? They'll say that like the boys are misogynistic. They're commenting on what girls are wearing, but they also have a uniform policy which comments on what girls are wearing. So on the same day, a teacher could go, you roll down your skirt and take off your nails or your eyelashes or whatever that looks like. And then a boy says something about her dress. And then he gets in trouble. And I'm like, that is so confusing. And like, if we want to kind of stamp out misogyny and what we'll do, and it goes back to that victim blaming stuff and kind of pinpointing, we'll go, what we need to do is we just need to work with boys and tell them X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, you can tell them whatever you want, but if their lived reality within the walls of your school is misogynistic, then telling them anything doesn't make any sense. And I guess, In order to answer your question about how do we get to slow down and how do we kind of embed that, again, it goes back to just like being honest. Like we're cramming young people, and like young people are like being sick before GCSE exams. And we're like, we all kind of know that GCSE exams, they're important, but they're not, it's not do or die. Do you know what I mean? Like, you shouldn't be on the verge of making yourself sick. So, and I remember one time my friend asked me if I would go and talk to a group of year 11s about their exams and not being stressed. And I was like, I can talk to the year 7s, but like, I'm not going to talk to the year 11s because they won't even believe me. They're just like, they believe that, right? They've kind of been indoctrinated in such a way that's it. So I think we have to kind of put things back in perspective. We say like humanity is first and then learning is second. But we like, there's a campaign at the moment which is like talking about lost learning. I'm like, yeah. What about the loss of humanity of children? Like, I can get behind like a lost learning. Like, I want young people to kind of access as much learning as possible, but like, not at the detriment of them as human beings. Mm. Because I think the thing we also kind of miss is that the young people who are successful in this moment and kind of do all of the right things, and they're like the model student, and like, I guess like, if your value is tied to how good you are at maths, for instance, like, and then you go on and you do like your A levels of maths, and you go into your degree in maths, and then you might get to a point where you go, I don't really know if I like maths, like, I don't really know who I am, because I wasn't able to kind of like construct my own identity. My identity was constructed for me because someone once told me I was really good at maths and I should just pursue that. So that's what I did. So then we have lots of people in therapy trying to work out who they are. And I think there's probably like, I say that to teachers and they will kind of just like give me a wry smile because they were like, yeah, I feel that. And like, we all know people who are going through that, trying to work out who they are. So if we co-construct young people's identity with them, then we also give ourselves a little bit of space. So we have to kind of, I think in order to actually slow down, we're going to have to kind of just like acknowledge and admit that like, it's important, but it's not the end of the world. Like, do you know what I mean? In terms of GCSEs, because that's the thing that gets everyone like, oh my God, like we have to get the, like, I really want this kid who's going to get an 8. I really want him to get a 9. Yeah. Come on. Like, it matters, but it's not that deep. Like, if they're going to get an 8, they're going to get an 8, and they're going to get an opportunity to do something else in their lives. But if we equip them with the ability which says you are valuable, like you are valuable above and beyond your grades, and you can think critically, and you can kind of galvanize support from elsewhere, then if you get an 8, you'll be able to go and talk and display that you are kind of 9. And the last thing I'll say on that as well, which is like kind of tied to it, is let's just for a moment imagine that we live in a capitalist society, right? Like, the way that we're treating young people is not even beneficial to kind of capitalist endeavors, right? Like, because if you speak to kind of, or if you read about what employers are saying about this generation of children, that they can't work together, they can't think critically, they can't engage. So I'm like, what are we even doing it for? Like, we're not producing the best workers. We're producing like a group of young people who are like mental health and well-being is going through the roof. And what's the outcome? The outcome is they're not even productive workers. I'm like, cool. If that was the aim that we wanted to get to,
we're not even getting there.
I'm like, we could be better at capitalism if that's what we really wanted to do. But for us, I'm just like, it's all very illogical. But once we understand that, then we would slow down. We'd be like, okay, yeah, like I do have a couple of moments to talk to you about, you know, what we did at the weekend. Mm. I do want to hear that question actually, even though it's not on topic. I have time for that because that's helpful in terms of affirming the group and kind of thinking about things and all of those different things. So yeah, like I think we have to kind of just acknowledge the truth that we already know.
And what you're saying reminds me of our last episode. Kezia, who's been a head teacher for a long time, was talking about accountability measures, and you know, she said like, scrap progress 8 and just, you know, measure me on how well my kids who've left my school are doing at 25, because you know, these kind of really narrow set of results at the end of year 11 or year 13, you know, they're not the be all and end all. And it's about so much more than that. And I think, you know, yeah, thinking about pupils, it shouldn't be a revolutionary idea that we want to think about pupils as whole human beings and develop them. And I think, you know, if you ask any teacher why they went into teaching, they're not going to say so that, like, you know, 80% of my class made this much progress. They're going to say to develop young people for the love of my subject, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And that's sort of missing a bit. And I guess, so I read a blog post on the Class 13 website that talked about deficit ideology being more than a mindset and being a system. And I think you talked a lot about the kind of things within the educational systems that are harmful. You know, these accountability measures, pace, the focus on sort of compliance as behaviour. And last time we spoke, you mentioned, I was talking, I think, about closing the gap. That's, you know, a phrase that's used a lot in education. And you were talking about Ladson Billings' work on educational debts. Yeah. And I wondered if you wanted to just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that's a really, I think it's a really helpful framing because, like, we are constantly trying to get young people to catch up. That's essentially what it is. But I think when Ladson Billings kind of describes it as a debt, then you can understand. And I think that, like, the debt that we kind of, that we owe to young people, which we're kind of doing right now, when we think about their parents as well, like the reason why their parents are engaging in school in a different way, or in, I guess, a more challenging way, is because they're also in debt. So that debt is only going to keep, like, being passed on. And what's really interesting about that as well is that, like, like, those parents value education because they didn't have it. So they want to kind of double down on all of that kind of interesting stuff. But it's like, it's going to keep perpetuating itself. So we have to kind of step back and say, like, what is it we're trying to achieve with these young people? And, like, what is it we want for, I guess, like, for wider society? Because I think what we kind of overlook, or we overlook, but we talk about in the adverts, that, like, teachers have an opportunity to kind of change lives, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they have opportunity to kind of change society. So if we want society to change, we can't teach conformity. It doesn't make any sense. But, like, going back to the kind of, the debt that is kind of, that is resting on these shoulders, like, it's gonna be there for, like, a while, and we're gonna have to kind of work with our parents and with our communities in order to make that change. Because when we talk about accountability measures and part of the project that we're doing is we're trying to get the schools to be accountable to community, because they can be accountable to Ofsted, and I'm like, that's fine, but, like, I don't know. I've yet to meet a teacher who really loves Ofsted, who thinks Ofsted is the greatest thing in the world. I'm just like, I haven't met that person yet. So that tells me something about the accountability measures. And we're like, oh yeah, but it's good. And we're like petrified of it. Like, we should not be petrified, but we should be more worried about our parents and our young people than we are of, like, Ofsted.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I feel like if we were in community with our parents and the students and our kind of staff, then we'd be better equipped to fight against, like, I guess, like, the kind of rigid accountability measures that kind of keep coming down. Because if we're at the moment, if you think about a school, like, trying to fight parents over here and then fight Ofsted over there, you're going to lose. But if you can go, we're going to galvanise, and we're like, we're probably not going to get outstanding, and that's because we're doing X, Y, and Z. Is everyone cool with that? Yeah, cool. Ofsted come, we understand we're not outstanding, no worries, we're good, we're keeping moving. Like, it's fine. And even if we wanted to get outstanding, we could go, we're going to get outstanding, and we'll do what schools do at the moment, right? And we'll perform on those days, and we could potentially get it, and then we'll go back to type. But I don't know. I don't really know, like, what we're doing in terms of accountability measures. But I do think in terms of deficit ideology being, I guess like a system, it really is an ideology, because it feeds into so much that we think and do, and we will often get asked, like, what is the opposite of deficit ideology? And the thing we have to say is it's not strengths-based, it's not asset-based, because asset-based and strengths-based basically say there's a successful norm here, and these are the ways that you're like that successful norm. Mm-hmm. Deficit thinking says there's a successful norm, and these are the ways you're not like it. It's two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
So we have to have a commitment to equity. That's the opposite of it. It's like, it's active, because deficit ideology is active. It's in everything. And we can look at things like I don't know, we can look at like evidence-based, but if your evidence-based intervention is based on a deficit assumption, then I care not for the evidence. It doesn't make any sense. Like there's like scientific records that say that like men are smarter than women because they got bigger heads. Mm-hmm. Is that an evidence-based? Should I just walk around saying that's correct? No, because we know that is it's a farce. So we also have to understand that like some of these evidence bases, which are basically just blaming young people, also has to be a farce because because it's not unique to this young person. Mm-hmm. Like it's happening for 50 plus years. So we have to do something very different in order to kind of to change that. But the thing we have to do is different. It's not like radical. Mm-hmm. It's not crazy. It's like, should we just honor everyone as human beings? Because at the moment, not even teachers are being treated as full human beings. Teachers are leaving because they're not being treated as full human beings. They're there and do you mean like you're a body in a room and like you need to control these 30 young people and all of that. And I think we're getting worse as well when we start introducing scripts for teachers. And that's because we're in this like horrible cycle where teachers are leaving. So when we get teachers in, and these teachers are coming in quicker and quicker, so then they're not as prepared to teach in the classroom. Yeah. So then we're like, how can we prepare them? How can we upskill them? Well, we can just like, we can de-skill all teachers and just give them a script. And then the teachers that do have some skills and stuff like that, they're like, I don't want to do a script because, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, this is a calling, this is my profession. So we're deprofessionalizing them, which again, when we deprofessionalize teachers, we're increasing the risk, like safeguarding concerns for young people. So we're increasing the vulnerability once again. But then once they leave, then we have to kind of double down and go, we need to be more punitive, we need to be more scripted, we need to do blah, blah, blah. And that's just where we're going. And I think the thing that we're not looking at, which is coming across the horizon, is the fact that, I call it a fact, maybe it's not, maybe it's just a fiction, maybe it's my idea. But like what I see coming is that young people who survive these punitive systems and feel like it was good for them in the same way as, you know, like someone will go, oh, I was in the army, it was really good for me. Mm-hmm. I went to prison, it straightened me out, like all of that kind of stuff. They're going to become teachers and they're going to become head teachers and their schools are going to be horrible because they survived that system and they thought it was the best for them. And that's where we're going to go. I'm like,
yeah. It's that age-old thing of like, oh, it didn't do me any harm. Yeah. It's like, it really did. And you're here perpetuating that harm.
Yeah. And that's where we're going. Like, if you were raised in a scripted school, super punitive, quiet corridors, I don't know what you're going to do when you run a school, but I can tell you it's not going to be good.
Yeah.
But we have to kind of put the brakes on that now. Mm. Because if we don't, it's just going to be too much to unpick. Which is why I say we keep creating rod throwing back.
Yeah, and I love the idea that the way we put the brakes on that is by slowing down and asking questions and forming community. Yeah. So like in our project, we're working with 10 schools in Bristol and their surrounding communities, and we're trying to build up this picture of Bristol and what that looks like educationally. And what we're finding is schools are saying, you know, we've got really great ties with the community. You know, we really understand the community, we sort of shape our curriculum for our community. And when we sort of delve a little bit deeper, it's like, okay, if you're shaping your curriculum for the community, then, you know, why are you teaching exactly the same as a school on the other side of Bristol? You know, where's the community input into that? And there's a big part of it missing. I think, you know, they may do some work with parents, but it's often they open to parents and parents self-select to come in. So there's a lot of parents missing from that.
And the debt will show up in that as well.
Yeah. And they're not actually engaging with the community, because I don't think schools really understand what community is beyond one. We have a school community, which is kind of everyone within our gates and maybe the parents. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a local community that we can kind of use as a resource. So we might go and visit something, or we might get a speaker in, but there's no sense of like community between the people in the school and just the locals living in that area. And I don't know, it feels like schools aren't communities anymore. And I guess that's part of that debt that we've been talking about that's been passed down. I mean, I don't know if that's What are your thoughts on that? Is there like, where's community gone? I kind of guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think you really have to be intentional. Like, you have to kind of be intentional and know that it's not going to kind of, like, you can be intentional about creating community, like now, and you might not see the rewards of that for 5 or 6 years. But if you believe that community is important, then you keep doing it because you know it to be important. Because it's not going to happen overnight, because people are just like, I send my kid to school and the school deals with that, and then they come back to me. So in order to kind of change that narrative and change that kind of culture, you're going to have to do it, but you have to kind of stay true. And I think what's really interesting is that we can take lessons from like the super punitive schools, so like the Makeda school or the Mosbourne schools, in terms of they are really going for what they're going for, right? They have an ideology, they believe in it, and that's what they're doing. They're following it through. And you have to admire that in some way, because it doesn't matter if the Guardian writes something or BBC says something, they're like, this is what we said, this is what we're doing. So the thing that I would say is that, like, you've got a school over here, which is bound prayer, and I'm saying to another school, maybe you should let children go to the toilet during their lessons. I'm like, it's okay. Like, they banned prayer. The Guardian wrote something and they didn't care. If we do this other thing over here, it's going to be okay, because no one's going to come in and go, oh my God, you let them go to the toilet. Yeah, because they're human beings. Like, on a basic level, like, we've got young people in a space who can't go to the toilet, who can't regulate their own body temperature because some schools will tell you you have to keep your blazer on until I decide it's too hot. And then I'm like, what's actually going on? And then you're like, learn, pay attention. Like, if I need to go to the toilet or if I'm too hot, I can't concentrate on anything. I'm like, it just doesn't make any sense. And even if the young person gets up and doesn't go to the toilet, oh, well, that's what we all do anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you go to university, if you go to places of learning, not everyone's sat inside. Some people put headphones on and reading. So we have to kind of prepare young people for actually what the world of learning looks like. But yeah, I don't know, I went off on a little tangent, but I think, like, in terms of community, we just have to be intentional. If we believe in it, then we do it. And I remember speaking to a school one time where we said to them, like, what do you want for your school? And they said all of these wonderful things. They want young people to feel valuable. They want young people to think critically. They want to blah, blah, blah. And I was like, so how do you measure this? And then they were like, we use the Ofsted framework. Actually, what I said in between actually was like, what prevents you from doing that? They said Ofsted. Then I said, how do you measure the thing that you want? And they said Ofsted. And I was like, so you put the barrier, because what you could do is you could measure what you want and then you fit that into the Ofsted framework. Not get Ofsted framework and then try and get what you want out of it. No, prioritize the thing that you want and then fit it into the other thing. Otherwise, I don't know. Otherwise, we're only going to get those outcomes. It's just a quick move, but it's not. And then we go, okay, this is really what we want, but we also know what Ofsted want. We're not going to pretend that they don't exist. Like, we know this is what we want. We know this is what Ofsted want, and we can do both things. But we're not going to kind of go, you know, walk around that Ofsted's like the holy grail, and they've got every young person's best interest at heart, because we can see that's not the truth. So measure what we actually want. So if we want community, be intentional and know that it's not going to happen in a year or two, and know that, like, there's long-term implementations, not just like, this time we're going to focus on that, and this next time we're going to focus on this. Like, it's nonsensical.
Absolutely. And I think that's scary for schools, isn't it? Saying maybe you don't have to do what Ofsted want, and, you know, you're not going to see instant results. It's, you know, and with high turnover of staff, etc., that can be really scary. But, you know, I don't know, none of what you're saying sounds scary to me. It sounds like common sense, you know, focusing on people as humans and thinking about the kind of humans that we want out in the world. Because, yeah, even by the kind of flawed system that we live in, we're not meeting that metric at the moment. You know, universities are saying kids aren't leaving college equipped to be undergraduates. Yeah. And, you know, that's a real problem. And what if we, you know, as a starting point, kind of looked at, like, what employers and universities want, you know, rather than, like, it leads me to think, like, whose metric is this? If it's not, you know, if it's not what capitalism wants, it's not what the employers and the universities want, like,
yeah,
I don't know. Where's it come from? And, you know, that could probably be a whole different conversation. But let's kind of, before we move on to our final question, did you want to say a little bit about the report that's being launched today?
Yes, today.
So it'll be out by the time the podcast goes out, but definitely. Exciting times.
Yeah, it is. It's really exciting. So like I said, it's our fifth birthday. So we're launching a report, which is an argument for possibility. So it's basically covering the bits that we're talking about now. And I guess it's slightly different to our reports, because we haven't just gone, these are all the things that are a problem. We know. We're like, these are the things that are a problem. And like, there's also some bits that we're probably not thinking about at the moment. But the soul is, for us, is easy, because it's just like, it goes back to that, let's just do what we know to be true, and let's just concentrate on these four principles, knowing that, like, we think that that matters, and it's going to kind of do something. The report's out. It talks a lot about our embedded pilot and what we're doing there, and like how we're doing that. And also, it's just like, I guess, helps us kind of understand deficit ideology a little bit better, because for some reason, I don't know why, but like, they talk a lot about it in America, but they don't talk about it so much in the UK. And what's really interesting for us, and it's probably like a little sidebar, is that like, we take this kind of, this learning from America, like Gloria Ladson-Billings, Paul Gorski, Richard Valencia, just and others also, like, I guess, like our kind of key thinkers are Paulo Freire and bell hooks, who are both fantastic thinkers. But when we kind of put that forward, people are like, oh, I don't know if something from America is going to work. And I'm like, all right, cool. So talk to me about Teach First then, my friends. You know what I mean? Like that.
Well, academies, which, you know, charter schools, like.
It's all there. So I'm like, we can copy it here, but over here we wouldn't copy it. It's like, why? Why would we not? But I think, a really kind of key understanding of deficit ideology and understanding kind of what that kind of leads to is, for us, is like super helpful, because I think if people read our report and they go and they're in a class the next day and say, oh, I think, is that deficit ideology? That's good, because that's slowing down. That's it. That's all you have to do is this question, just go, is it that? And you're like, I don't know. And that for us is like a huge impact, because it means that you might engage in a conversation with your colleague. It means that you're engaging in critical reflection yourselves, and you're going, oh, maybe I will change that slightly, or maybe I'll think about that. But like, going through the motions is not going to be the one. Like, counting down the holidays, it's not going to be the one, right? So we have to kind of think about ways that we can just pause our practice. And I hope that the report kind of offers that as like a helpful kind of way to support people to be able to articulate their frustration, because they're all very, like, all of the challenges that we see in education, mental health, teacher attention, mental health and behavior and exclusions, they're all very much linked. They're all just playing into each other. And the more that we kind of, the more we exclude, or I guess like the more the teachers leave, more we have to exclude, because we have to get more narrow with behavior, because we're getting more teachers in that, and it's just like, it just compounds, and it's just like this horrible cycle that we're going to kind of keep going. And I think when we were doing the report, we were talking about it as a cycle, but we couldn't work out where it started, because it's got it's like a chicken and egg kind of situation. It's like, was it teachers left first, or did we get super punitive? But like, when relationships break down, we get more punitive, right? Like,
yeah.
So that just makes sense. Like, even in like the workplace, like we go and get the policy when the relationship is not there.
Yeah.
Like, well, we're just going down the policy route, because we're going to kind of separate this out. We're just going to be robotic. So that's what's happening in the schools at the moment. So we have to get back to a place where we're like, oh, young people are human beings. Mm. Teachers are human beings. TAs are human beings. Parents also human beings. Mm. And let's like think about that. But at the moment, we're kind of partitioning people as kind of, some people are full human, some people are semi-human, some people are non-human, like in that education space, and no one is like less than a human being. Like, if you're not valued, it's just like you being a person, then we're you know, we're chipping away at all of those kind of ways that young, well, I guess we're chipping away, but we're just increasing all those risk factors, which are going to leave young people vulnerable in the very end, which is super sad.
100%. And I think I know the answer to this question because you've already articulated it, but because we end all of our episodes this way, I'm going to ask, what would a just education system look like to you?
A just education system would look like thinking about humans first. So it would be built on the humanity of individuals. And I think there's really something like powerful that Paulo Freire would say in terms of when we dehumanize anybody, we're actually dehumanizing ourselves, because central to kind of understanding humans is seeing humans and recognizing other people as human beings. And then in school, it plays out really interestingly, because we don't let kids go to the toilet. And then when you look at the stats around which professions are more likely to get UTIs, teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So both of us are not able to do basic stuff, which means that neither of us are able to be human in this space. So I think being able to kind of put really relationships, humanity at the forefront, and really just work towards something, knowing that it also is probably not going to happen in our lifetime, which is fine. But we have to start walking that path, because if we keep going down these other paths at the moment, it's going to be a little bit crazy. And I feel like probably my most unpopular opinion would be that, in terms of schools as well, a just education system would probably wouldn't have a mentoring project attached, right? It probably wouldn't have a mental health kind of worker embedded in the school, which, mental health charities will advocate for obvious reasons. One, because that's what young people need, but two, obviously, it's going to sustain the organisation as well. So there's a dual purpose. For us, we want to kind of give the practice out as best as possible and then cease to exist, because we're if we can change two schools, then as a team of five or six, we've probably done what we could do. We're not going to change the world, but we can change a couple of schools. So I think just education would probably just make more sense. It would probably kind of tick some kind of capitalist outcomes, as well as kind of just kind of affirming the humanity of young people and teachers. It's not even radical, it's just logic. And we're going to have to do it at some point.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really nice place to finish, that, you know, these aren't, nothing you've said today is a radical idea. It's just about caring for people and treating them well. And, you know, then all that other stuff that, you know, Ofsted want to measure and, you know, schools want to be seen to be successful in, that will follow.
Yeah.
You know, if you affirm people's humanity, then they'll do well.
Yeah. If people think about their workplace, right? If your workplace is more friendly or inviting, kind of caring for you, productivity goes up. Because people feel that's the logic we're following. We're not saying we don't care about exams. We care, it's okay. But we just want to create a better environment for young people to be able to do that, where they feel just I feel valued. And if I don't get the result, I also understand that I'm valuable. So therefore, it's not going to be so detrimental to me that I'm never going to be able to recover, I'm going to be sick and blah, blah, blah. It's I didn't get the result. Okay, no worries. I've got plan B, I've got plan C, and we keep it moving. And that's the type of young people we probably want in the world anyway, who can kind of, do you know what I mean? I won't use the word resilience, because I think it's a bit of an ugly word.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to get young people to be, they shouldn't have to be resilient to be able to access education. I think that's a bit mad. But I think that for us is, I guess, a different way of understanding or articulating resilience, to be able to think critically and move forward if you want.
And to be able to believe in themselves.
Yeah.
So, well, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much. And good luck for the launch tonight.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be easy.
Thank you for listening to the Repair Ed podcast. Please take a listen to our other episodes. And if you'd like to be a guest, get in touch. Our email can be found on our website, www.repair-ed.uk.